Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Welcome to the Sydney Institute's first virtual address with Carl Robinson, who I'll introduce briefly. We're doing these addresses. Our speaker will speak, then we'll do questions and discussion. So Carl Robinson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here, I think, in around the mid-1990s. He worked in USAID. He left USAID whilst he was in Vietnam, shortly after the Tet Offensive. He joined Associated Press. He worked for Associated Press in Vietnam and subsequently in Australia. And then in Australia later on, he worked for Newsweek. Then, of course, he established the famous old Saigon restaurant in Sydney. He worked on the Sydney Olympics. He worked on the film The Quiet American. He's written a book, Australia and Mongolia. And, of course, currently these days he takes tours and reunions to Vietnam. But on this occasion, Carl Robinson's going to talk for us on his most recent book, The Bite of the Lotus, an intimate memoir of the Vietnam War, which has been praised by Fox Butterfield, the Pulitzer Prize winner, as a real-life sequel to Graham Greene's 1955 classic, The Quiet American. So you've got a big mountain to climb tonight, Carl, but welcome and good luck.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and it's a very exciting, I would say, return here. That was 1995, 25 years ago, that I last spoke to the Sydney Institute, and that was exactly 20 years after the fall of Saigon in April 1975. I had just returned to Vietnam for the first time since the war, and you might remember, Gerard, it was like all that anger and bitterness of the war, and especially its aftermath, had suddenly disappeared. I was on a high. It was like water off a duck's back. I could finally look at Vietnam square in the eye again after all those years. But I offered in my address to the Sydney Institute, I offered a new perspective. I think the gist of it, we're in the middle of moving house, so I don't really have the Sydney Papers article, but what I was urging was a new perspective on the Vietnam War, that we weren't so wrong after all. It was more just the way we did it. And most importantly, what had just happened to me was I realized how naive and wishful thinking I had been to ever think that we could have done a deal with the communist side. And especially after hearing and seeing firsthand what those bastards had done to the place since 1975, and now years after the Berlin Wall came tumbling down, I finally became an anti-communist and completed the process of re-examining my lifelong, lazy, typical journo lefty outlook to a more conservative and, I would say, realistic political outlook. And now that we're on the eve of the 45th anniversary of the fall of Saigon at the end of April, let me take you back to those long ago days. It is 28th of April, 1975, and Saigon is falling, and I'm home for lunch. For the last 11 years, I've lived and worked in South Vietnam, first as a civilian advisor with the U.S. government, and then a photographer and journalist with the Associated Press, or the AP. Over the past 6 weeks, the entire north of the country has fallen to the North Vietnamese Army, and fighting now rages on the city's outskirts. Desperate hopes for a last-minute ceasefire and political solutions surround the afternoon's inauguration of neutralist and ex-general Nguyen Van Big Min, which I'm covering. My father-in-law's Citroen Tu Cheval is outside. I haven't seen him since my wife and two young children were ordered out 10 days before. We share an abiding disdain for the U.S.-backed Saigon government, the Saigon regime, and we were lulled by the communist promises of national reconciliation and no recriminations, and we had no plans to leave. But no, he's changed his mind. He wants to escape. When where's the rest of the family, I ask. Still in Gokong, he glumly replies, 60 kilometers and 3 hours away in the northern Mekong Delta. But tragically, everything is too late as events madly accelerate out of control over the next 24 hours and end with my running for one of the last choppers out of Saigon with only my wife's brother and a niece, the rest of her family, and my own beloved homeland abandoned. And that, at quite a head-spinning pace, is how my memoir of the entirety of the Vietnam War begins. Then more languidly, chapter 2 opens with my arrival in Saigon in early 1964 aboard a French passenger ship from Hong Kong as a curious university student on a month-long break during the Chinese New Year break of my university in Hong Kong. I was immediately enchanted and in love with Vietnam. And that's the underlying meaning of the bite of the lotus, an enchantment. The lotus is, of course, the symbol of Vietnam. And the bite of the lotus is an expression I heard very early on. I've forgotten it where I heard it from, a French-speaking Vietnamese or an American or what, but the bite of the lotus stuck with me for all those years. It's basically I became enchanted. And of course, there's one particular person who gave me a bite as well. So the book then follows my next 11 years in South Vietnam as the war exploded. The Americans came, trashed, and left. And finally, back to the opening chapters, bitter, bitter ending, and that chopper out of Saigon. The sequel to what happened after 1975 and my ending up in Australia and start of a new life is an epilogue entitled Epiphany, which refers back to what I was just saying about my address here in 1995. But by way of prequel, and actually in my original manuscript, which I completed 6 years ago, and is often referred to in passing in the book, are about my Congo days. In case you're wondering about my accent here, I was born in the U.S. in 1943 and grew up in the Belgian Congo as the son of Methodist missionaries until the age of 15, or 1958. English was actually my second language, with all my early education in French. And also, I spoke Swahili with all the Congolese kids in the neighborhood. Later, at a missionary kids' school run by Southern Presbyterians, so you can imagine how my English sounded after all that. From my parents, I always had a very keen interest in news and current events. They subscribed to Time magazine. Dad was always getting angry at Time magazine. At shortwave BBC News, the Lily Bolero appealing at 8 p.m. news. World News was always bedtime for us when we were growing up as kids. But I remember hearing about the Korean War, the Soviet invasion of Hungary, the Suez incident. I grew up with all those. You know, I was very young, but I knew about all those things. And then, of course, the heartbreak of Congo's independence in 1960 and the secession of copper-rich Katanga, where I had actually grown up, and then the UN intervention there. But also, while I was originally an Adlai Stevenson fan, I was drawn into the idealism of John F. Kennedy and when he was elected in 1960, and I planned to join the Peace Corps, perhaps even become a diplomat after university. My point is, I was always a very serious guy. I wasn't very frivolous. I, as I said, I paid a lot of attention to what was happening around me. I finished high school in Los Angeles, and as I started university in late 1961, like every young man, I was required to register for the draft. But influenced by my pacifist parents and the example of my older brother, I ticked off conscientious objector and received an automatic student deferment. After 5 years back in the U.S., however, I was ready to get out. And very much on a whim, I decided to take my junior or third year of university in Hong Kong, but I needed my draft board's permission to go overseas, something that people would not really understand today. So much to my surprise, I was sent a long form to fill out, justifying my CO position. It was a bit of a struggle, really, and all very theoretical. You needed religious grounds in those days, and after The Catcher in the Rye and UNESCO's Rhinoceros and Kafka's Metamorphosis, my young mind was really all over the place. I can't really say I was very religious anymore. But I did get my draft board's permission, and I never thought that deeply about my convictions, much less that I would end up in the middle of a real-life war zone. So my pacifism, and basically just wanting everybody to get along, and a reflection of my missionary upbringing, is clearly an underlying theme of my story. I always saw the war in more in political terms. My early support for a neutralist solution in Vietnam, a coalition government, opposition to U.S. ground troops and the Saigon regime, winning the hearts and minds of people, what you'd call nation building later on. Later, my friendship and support of South Vietnam's non-communist nationalist opposition, the so-called Third Force, all doomed causes, of course. My memoir is a history of the entire Vietnam War from start to finish. And there's even a chronology at the front of the book to help you out, and told through my own personal journey, the whole damn movie. And speaking modestly, I was a pretty ordinary guy as well. I was a young idealist trying to win the hearts and minds, and then just another hack in the vast Saigon press corps, but with all the war's major events a constant backdrop to my story. The narrative is contemporaneous. What I saw and felt at the time, with only the rare retrospection, it is evocative of time and place, fast-moving and full of anecdotes. My story is also brutally honest, unemotionally and unembarrassingly so. And from all my years in Australia, it's also very self-deprecating and laconic. Many have remarked on my memory for detail, work and personal, how pacification worked, or was supposed to anyway, how I lived, worked, and socialized, conversations and incidents, the salacious bits, girlfriends, my love story with Kim Jong, the bite of the lotus, later, the drugs, the romance of opium, and the dregs of heroin itself. My narrative is hardly heroic or boastful. Looking back, I was often stupidly brave, out there on the edge, repeatedly saved by a lucky star. I was idealistic, naive, the full range of human emotions and contradictions. The tragedy of our lost child, our first child, friends killed, wounded, or just disappeared, the doldrums of wire service journalism, the adrenaline rush of combat, the joys of family life, and bright rainy season days. But always from a unique perspective, especially the details of the day-to-day life of the Vietnamese, their culture and traditions, love of family, endurance, and resilience. And now I would like to read some extracts from the book, working with the chronology of the war itself. Now, when I arrived in Saigon on that French ship in early 1964, how I felt. I had few preconceptions about South Vietnam, but I genuinely believed America was right to be there. It did start off as a very idealistic adventure, people have forgotten. Having grown up overseas, I didn't think much of my country's depressing parochialism and the dreadful superficiality of its pop culture. But I did believe in its great principles and ideals. Shattered as I was by his assassination, I was still a JFK idealist. Like many of my generation, I was caught up in the excitement of Kennedy's 1960 election. His inauguration speech about defending freedom around the world resonated strongly and personally with me, compared to the ham-fisted, mutually assured destruction nuclear policy of Republican President Dwight D. Eisenhower and his reactionary Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. JFK would surely reform the country's ugly international image. But after a Berlin crisis or two, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis, I understood that worldwide communism was a startling reality. We'd seen the emergence of East Germany and West Germany, North Korea and South Korea, and now the same division here in Vietnam. Although philosophically I was a pacifist and hardly a strident anti-communist, I had seen and read enough to know that the communists weren't the good guys. My brief time in Hong Kong and the fringes of what China was going through after its disastrous Great Leap Forward only confirmed that impression. America had a duty to actively and constructively confront the spread of communism. So that's how I started off. I'm often asked, how long were you there? How long were you there when I ended up getting a job there with USAID and coming back after that year in Hong Kong? How long were you there before you realized it was all a doomed exercise? And I said, about 2 weeks. But working down in the province, Gokong province, which I referred to earlier, which became my adopted home in Vietnam. I was a member of a very small advisory team. This was 64, 65. And the election, 64 election between LBJ and Goldwater, where Goldwater was being portrayed as a warmonger, and LBJ won election in his own right as president. And we went into a period there, and this is also after the Gulf of Tonkin incident, we went into a period there where what's going to be happening next as the communists started putting pressure on the Americans, basically daring the Americans to do something. Now, we were aware of divisions in the U.S. mission between civilians led by Ambassador Taylor and the military. The civilians didn't want military intervention, but the VC attacks grew bolder, like the car bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon in March 1965. There was a growing sense of doom. Down in Gokong, we, our little team, about a dozen, mostly military, just a couple of civilians, we met the prospect of U.S. ground troops in South Vietnam with skepticism. Other Americans in My Tho and Four Corps headquarters in Can Tho felt similarly. Officers from our team brought back incredible stories and rumors of what MACV, the U.S. command, had in mind. They surely weren't listening to us. But we and Advisory Team 83 had many late night conversations over a can or two of cheap American beer about what was coming. Why should GIs come in when even the South Vietnamese don't want to fight, someone would say. Let's just wrap up the war and leave right now. That was how most of us felt, me included. Then a yell from somebody else. Yeah, let's give them the whole country. It'll set world communism back by 20 years. No, you can't really do that, I said. What about all the pretty girls? No, what we should do is give every man, woman, and child in South Vietnam $1 million each. They'd be too busy making money to fight. Yay, cheers, and a toast all around. But there would be no U.S. ground troops in South Vietnam. On that, we all agreed. But more realistically, I felt if we did bring in U.S. troops, we should integrate them with South Vietnamese army into mixed units, the Yanks eating rice and the Viets eating sea rations, our hearts and minds united in the struggle. But of course, no one in Saigon was listening to us. The dice was rolling, and of course, in early March 1965, the U.S. Marines landed in Da Nang, and the Australians followed shortly afterwards. I after that first year in Vietnam, I went back and finished university and came back with USAID and ended up back in Gokong again. And the team had just mushroomed. We were now like a parallel government to the Saigon government. And our group of civilian and military advisors, we get together for drinks and so on in the evening, and our conversations also touched on the morality of what our government was doing here. This is by 1966, 67, when light was supposed to be at the end of the tunnel. We were winning the war. There were almost 500,000 troops, U.S. troops in Vietnam at this stage. We touched on the morality of what the government was doing here and the tactics that it was using, the moral dilemma of Vietnam. We had no firsthand knowledge of what things were like for U.S. ground troops, although the 9th Division was moving in next door in Dinh Thuong province and would soon wreak havoc across the northern Mekong Delta. But we did see and hear how the VC treated people with compulsion, indoctrination, taxes, assassinations. We saw buses and mini taxis blown up by remote controlled mines with atrocious civilian casualties. The VC's outright acts of terrorism, including random water and rocket shellings in Saigon and other urban centers, were obvious. They ruled by fear and intimidation. We saw the so-called National Liberation Front, the NLF, for the phony bunch they were, controlled by Hanoi. They were the ones who wanted to destroy an open and comparatively free society and ruin people's ordinary lives. The Viet Cong sure weren't the good guys, so we wondered, how should we fight back? Be as mean and nasty as they are? Should we descend to their level of violence and terror to win this war? We still believed, and desperately wanted to believe, that what we were doing was right and moral. But was it? Or had we already crossed the line? That was 67. And Tet, and that was, of course, not long after that came the Tet Offensive. The Tet Offensive of 1968. By then I had met this sweet young lady in Gokong called Kim Jung, we were in Gokong for the Tet Offensive, and it was about the only city that was not hit by the Viet Cong during that offensive. But by the time we got to Kantai, it was just the whole delta had been decimated, and for me it was like the last straw, seeing how the Americans had bombed their own people, basically their own allies. And I quit USAID in protest over U.S. policy in Vietnam, and Kim Jong and I ran away to Saigon, and that's where my journalism career began. Basically, I was hired out of a Saigon bar. I didn't want to leave Vietnam, even though the American government wanted to get me out as soon as possible. But I got a job with the Associated Press, basically writing captions. So it was like a foot in the door of journalism. We used to call it the Saigon School of Journalism. You got off a plane and got yourself accredited, and it was like, I mean, people could still do that these days with wars if they wanted to. But that's how I started in journalism, basically writing captions and then becoming a photographer, and then later on a full-time correspondent or writer. Meanwhile, Kim Jong had run away from home basically to be with me and our little love nest up in Saigon, and I felt really bad that she had lost touch with her family, so I began negotiations with her father for marriage, and I used intermediaries, and her father was totally against our marriage. He turned me down. It was tougher negotiating marriage with my future wife than it was for the negotiators in Paris to agree on the shape of the negotiating table, you might remember. And finally it was down to just Kim Jong was the interpreter at her own matchmaking here in the end. And so we went down to Gokong. This is before Tet, and so we had a really nice launch. But this is before Tet of 1969, and it was time for some serious marriage talks with Kim Jong's father, so we had a nice little lunch, and then her father had a few questions here. Was I married already? It was not a dumb question, as many Americans were taking second wives in Vietnam, with all the ceremony, even the paperwork, and later abandoning them. No, I replied, I have never been married. Kim Jong was the oldest of five children from the second marriage of both parents, whose earlier ones had produced three older girls. And so with no number one son or daughter in southern Vietnamese culture, only two, she was number five, or Nam, which is how she is generally addressed, except by her own parents, who call her Jung. This daughter was not just beautiful, but precious too, and her father worried that I'd be taking her away, never to be seen again. No, I assured him, I'm not planning to leave Vietnam. I never want her to lose touch with her own family. He seemed satisfied, and then said, I have one more question for you. And if I'm satisfied with your reply, you can marry my daughter. And I said, yes. I said anxiously, what is it? Taking a deep breath and looking at me straight in the eye, he asked, do you work for the CIA? I laughed out loud and looked at Kim Jong. I said, that's his last question. So I passed. No, I'm not with the damn CIA, I sputtered and burst into a wide grin. So now I can marry your daughter, right? Yes, we all laughed. So preparations for our wedding began. But first we needed to fix a date, and not just any date. Kim Jong's mother consulted a soothsayer. I don't really like the term fortune teller, to pinpoint an auspicious day. After just one look at our animal years, however, he threw up his hands in despair. No, these two are not compatible. She is a buffalo and he is a goat. You can picture that. Of the 12 animal years on the lunar zodiac, we were directly opposite each other. And that wasn't good, apparently. Plus, our respective horns would, logically, always be locking together and fighting. But they're in love, and we've given our approval, protested Mother. Reluctantly, the soothsayer continued his deliberations and finally declared that there was only one auspicious day in all of 1969, the 26th of May. Otherwise, it would have to wait until next year. Okay, then. And I was fully accepted by her father after all that refusal earlier on. I became his favorite son-in-law. My book also talks about my friendship with my friendships, and particularly my friendship with John Steinbeck. This is actually John Steinbeck IV. He was the son of the famous novelist and war correspondent, actually, but rather estranged. And also, more closely, I was good friends with Sean Flynn, who was the son of actor, Australian, Tasmanian-born actor Errol Flynn. And I describe in the book the motorcycle trips that we took down to the Cambodian border, in our case, to pick up some more dope that we ran out. And then also more bravely, I would say, or stupid brave, up through Laos from Vientiane to Luang Prabang, and that's all described in some detail. And in 1970, after the overthrow of Sihanouk, he and another friend disappeared in eastern Cambodia in one of the enduring mysteries of the Vietnam War. Now, I would have almost been there. It was, again, a lucky star thing that if I'd been there that day, I've always wondered if I would have tried to talk Sean out of going down that road and getting captured, because it was the sort of thing we had done already. So then my career as a full-blown journalist finally took off, you know, from being just a bloody caption writer. So by the Laos invasion of 1971, which was an attempt to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail, this is a year after the fall of Cambodia, I wasn't really expected in my job to do any combat. That was really, there were plenty of, I dare say, volunteers for that task. But I've never actually pretended to be a war correspondent. As I said earlier, I always saw it more as a political struggle. But in this case, I did end up on the Laos border in a U.S. firebase, because the U.S. ground troops, unlike Cambodia the year before, were not allowed to cross into Laos with the South Vietnamese troops. So I was with this guy who had given me a lift out to this firebase, and as soon as we got there, we came under North Vietnamese long-range artillery fire from inside Laos, and we went diving into this bunker. And they made room for me because I didn't have a helmet or a flak jacket or anything on, and so there I was with the same guy who had given me a lift, and then coming out of what, so every time you could actually hear the click of the round, and then the whistle, and it was just fragments going all over the firebase where we were, and I had never actually been under that sort of thing, and I came out, so every time you'd hear it, you'd sort of scrunch up. So coming out of one scrunch from an incoming round, my GI friend handed me a cigarette through a narrow space between the sandbags, and he said, here, have some of this. I said, geez, the last thing I needed was a joint. He says, no, no, better not. I said, it'll just freak me out. No, man, this will make you relaxed. So I accepted his offer, and soon I realized I wasn't smoking dope, but heroin, pure 95% smack. He just picked up a fresh batch for himself and his mates from some Arvins back at Quezon, and damn if things didn't start feeling a lot more relaxing. After a couple cigarettes, I could have stayed there the rest of the day. The NVA artillery kept coming in, and we didn't even bother scrunching up anymore. The GI told me his story, and now he just wanted to go home to Cleveland and work as a mortician. What, after seeing all this death and destruction in Vietnam? After a couple hours, the barrage finally stopped, and as we crawled out of our shelters, my head was spinning. You'd better get going, my friend advised, and I rushed down to the road to hitch a ride back to Quezon. I didn't need to go to the border crossing at Lao Bao anymore. So right away we...
5 minutes.
Right away we... I got a lift with some South Vietnamese airborne troops. Right away we got into an ambush, and I got out. And I had never been in combat before. They fired a couple of rounds at us, and the whole convoy of vehicles stopped. Without thinking of the danger, I hopped out of the Jeep and began taking pictures. Should I thought this is real. With a gunner grimacing at the outgoing fire, I saw that the front of his armored vehicle was decorated with flowers and the peace sign. Then one of the airborne troops ran up and yelled for me to get back in the Jeep. The road was open again. It was nice of them not to leave me behind. I had made my dash and finally got my taste of combat. I now knew the exhilaration of getting shot at and surviving. The adrenaline kicking in when everything slows right down, and I could feel and sense everything around me in brilliant colors. There's no other high like it. I could understand the addiction. I could see that, yes, you could get yourself killed doing shit like that, but there's no greater feeling than getting shot at and surviving. So that was 1971. 1973, January 1973, was the Paris ceasefire agreement. A lot of the media organizations cut back on their staff. I stayed on with the AP, and that was really the peak of my time as a journalist, but also I fell into the, as I referred earlier, the addiction of heroin, which I'm quite honest about and why that happened. But it was all part of the slow deterioration. It's like being on a train that you knew was going to wreck, and it was sort of like taking Prozac three times a day or whatever. But it was really. By the time Vietnam ended, I was really just a nervous wreck when I ran for that helicopter. But everything fell apart after all those years.
Many thanks. Take a seat, yeah. Carl. So many thanks to Carl Robinson. I'm about to enter into a Q&A with Carl, but I just, before we do it, The Bite of the Lotus, an intimate memoir of the Vietnam War, a very intimate and very frank memoir, as you will have observed. We'll be selling copies of this book, signed copies of this book, on our website from tomorrow. So now I'm going to have a chat to Carl. Thanks for that, Carl. Very, very frank, I must say. I'm really pleased you became a born-again anti-communist at the Sydney Institute. There's no better place to become a born-again anti-communist. But can I just take you back to the year before you arrived in Vietnam, because you arrived in Vietnam in 1964.
Right.
But it seems to me that the war was lost in November 1963 when, as you describe it in your glossary, an American-backed coup overthrew Diem, who, whatever his faults, was the only leader South Vietnam really ever had. He was overthrown. You arrive in 64. By that stage, there is no real legitimate government in South Vietnam. So how did you interpret arriving in 64, the overthrow of Diem the previous year?
Well, of course, and of course, just a week before, Big Men, who starts the book there, he had been overthrown in a coup because he was too much of a neutralist.
That's the week before you arrived.
Yeah, the week before
so
I arrived.
That's 64. Right?
Yeah, early 64. Okay. And there'd been a great high the people who they were described as a revolution by the students and Buddhists and everyone who had overthrown GM. But what replaced it was just this rabble, really, who were constantly fighting among themselves, like warlordism, took over. But I think that was a tragedy. You're right that GM was the only effective leader they ever had, and he knew the communists and how they operated very well. It's too bad that he wasn't able to establish more of a stronger anti-communist nationalist coalition. That was his problem.
Our one-time Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, who was a prominent liberal, backbencher liberal in the mid-1960s and then became a minister, in his memoirs said that he was never aware of any American or CIA involvement in the ZM overthrow, but he must have been the only person in the world who wasn't, because we discussed this at school in 1963. So what did you know about the American involvement when you arrived there in 64?
Oh, it was just generally assumed that was what had happened. I mean, it was a very small mission. The American mission was very small, and everyone sort of knew each other or knew about each other. And of course, the Americans had their fingers all over it. But they wanted to make it look, of course, like it was something that the South Vietnamese decided on their own. There's always this appearance. Like even when we brought troops in, you had all these musical chairs. Government, they were invited in. You might remember Australia waited until they were invited to come in by just another one of these like musical chairs governments that was part of the early days, my early days in South Vietnam.
What was the view then at the time about why the Americans? Here we're talking about, as you said, the Kennedy administration. It's not quite clear to what extent President Kennedy was involved. He is said to have been deeply disturbed by ZM's death, a fellow Catholic, but he was clearly involved in it. Well, not necessarily his death, but he was involved in the overthrow. So why do you think the Americans felt the need to overthrow the ZM government?
Well, I've always wondered. I've done more reading on this recently. I think they really went around Kennedy it was like a weekend message that went to Saigon to give the go-ahead for that coup.
Yes.
And I think Kennedy, sad to say, was really out of. He tried to wind the thing back after he heard that the message had gone to start talking to the generals. I think he did. It's too bad that he didn't make a more public gesture or something, or could have had. I think the die was already cast at that stage, unfortunately.
Now, did you enter USAID? Because you're a bit naive, and I make the point, I mean, you thought that a neutral government could emerge in South Vietnam, but over the border was a hardline Stalinist communist dictatorship led by Ho Chi Minh. So how could you ever have imagined that sort of regime in the 1950s into the 60s would tolerate a neutral, non-communist government in the South?
Well, you remember next door was neutralist Cambodia. With Sihanouk, he was.
Yeah, but it wasn't next door to North Vietnam.
I know, but I think in that early stages where there was more or less an equilibrium between the two states as far as military power and so on were concerned, that I think if the And Charles de Gaulle in September of 1963 in Phnom Penh, in fact, had called for the neutralization of South Vietnam. I think if it was something that was backed by the French and the Americans, that it could have had a greater chance of success. But and before the hardliners took over completely in North Vietnam, it would have been. But of course, the whole Third World Movement was something that we weren't going to get involved with. Remember, with Sukarno and India and who were the other, China even, right? The non-aligned movement. I think it could have worked if the Americans had thrown their weight behind it, but they couldn't have done that, especially a Democratic Party regime. But there was also the model of the neutralization of Laos. Even though the effect of all that was just to turn the war secret and allow the North Vietnamese to keep using the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Yeah. So,
So why, I mean, if you go back to what the left was saying on university campuses and elsewhere in the 60s, that, you know, they're all, that the problem with the South Vietnamese government was they there should have been a genuine election for the whole of Vietnam, yet we know there was not one chance in a million that North Vietnam would allow a genuine election. So,
exactly.
Again, that was a degree of naivety, wasn't it? The concept that somehow this could be resolved by a free election when there were more people in the North than there were in the South, and no one in the North had any freedom at all, whereas in the South there was quite a degree of political freedom.
That's right.
I mean, you sort of describe it in your book, don't you? You've got all these various factions, but if all these different groups are competing, there's some degree of political, a substantial degree of political freedom.
Well, I think in a totally, ironically, in a totally free election, you know, there's supposed to be an election in 1956.
Yeah.
With that disastrous land reform program in the North, there was a lot of animosity toward the communist regime, that Ho Chi Minh himself had to finally step in and draw that to a halt. I think it's arguable, you know, whether you could have had, you know, how that election would have gone. It's just a point of speculation, of course.
Oh, come on, Carl. But, I mean, there was never any communist regime of the Stalinist kind or the Maoist kind or the Ho Chi Minh kind that ever had a free election. I mean, or the North Korean kind.
Oh, you're right.
It couldn't happen, could it?
Yeah.
So that was, I mean, that argument was going nowhere. I mean, as you will recall, the argument also in the 60s from the left was that the Viet Cong or the National Liberation Front was completely independent and there weren't any North Vietnamese forces in
That's right.
Vietnam. Now, how did you see it when you arrived there in 64? To what extent was the National Liberation Front Viet Cong independent?
I always saw them as just a front. I mean, that's what they were.
Yeah.
They even called themselves a front.
National Liberation Front.
Of course, the communists jazzed it up. They called themselves the Workers' Party. Remember, they didn't become the Communist Party until after 1975. But there was another model that we would talk about. I mean, we just, you know, we sat around talking seriously all the time was the Tito model, if that was a possibility, of exploiting the traditional anti-Chinese sentiment of the Vietnamese and trying to, he would have taken a lot more nuance and everything that the Americans were prepared to.
Well, as you know, you're talking about Tito, the leader of Yugoslavia, who wasn't quite aligned with Moscow, but he wasn't quite hostile to Moscow either. So you're there. I mean, as you know, the Americans go in, you point this out in your book, in combat forces really go in 65, Australian combat forces around the same time. I think our forces performed very well in the circumstances in the areas where they were given. So you're there 64, 65, 66, 67, and then comes Tet in 68, and you at that stage you think, you get out of USAID and you become a journalist.
Yeah.
But one of our members here, Owen Ether, made this point to me today, and I agree with it substantially, but I'm interested in your opinion, that the Tet Offensive was a total military failure. The North Vietnamese suffered about 60% battle casualties, half killed in action, and did not overthrow the South Vietnamese government. The Viet Cong were virtually annihilated as an effective military force, and there was no mass uprising as had been expected. So in a military sense, I think that analysis is pretty well correct. In a military sense, the Tet Offensive was not a victory, but in a sense that you and many saw it, it was a huge defeat for the US. So how do you put those two together? You win on the ground, but you lose the argument.
Well, my beef was more the way that they were running the war, frankly. That was always my argument. I think we never really paid close enough attention, even to just having like a decent level sort of relationship with the South Vietnamese. I think that was a great, and I saw that it was a military defeat for the communists. They were seriously wiped out down in Go Kong province for the first time. Going back there, I could go anywhere I wanted to because they were either killed or they amnestied, the Chu Hoi themselves, the Viet Cong. But at the same time, the Saigon government had an unparalleled opportunity after 1968, after the Tet Offensive, to create a broad coalition sort of government. But again, they couldn't do it. Nguyen Van Thieu was the president. He was fighting with Win Khao Ky. There was a lost opportunity there after 1968, where the Viet Cong had been defeated, and the North Vietnamese Army. That's the only they were running the war then. I think a good government after 68 would have made a big difference and made South Vietnam a viable and strong state, but that didn't happen.
And that goes back to the earlier point that after Diem, there was no effective government. I mean, whatever his faults, his government was reasonably effective for the time, but
That's right. That,
it wasn't there. And so then you lead on to a gradual American withdrawal, but the Americans keep supplying. Meanwhile, supplies to the North Vietnamese come in from the Soviet Union, which the Americans never really stop, although they could have, and to some extent from China. But then come Watergate and all that, the American pledges to supply the South Vietnamese regime, which was fighting, for all its faults, quite bravely against a very well-supplied force. I mean, as you know, the North Vietnamese had the capacity to knock the most developed U.S. fighter warplanes out of the sky with Soviet supplies weapons. So this was a very sophisticated army at a certain level. So, but once that happened, once the U.S. chopped off military or virtually abandoned military supplies at that stage, there was nothing much left, was there?
Well, by that stage, the Democrat Party-controlled Congress was really running foreign policy. And one of the very perverse things just after the Paris Peace Agreement was Congress voted not to give reparations to the North, where something like that might have mellowed things or at least calmed things down. There were also political provisions in the Paris Peace Agreement, which would have been, you know, which the Americans had, they'd put so much pressure on Nguyen Van Thieu to sign the Paris Peace Agreement, they weren't going to lean on him again. But I think there were I think in the end, certainly the South Vietnamese had all that equipment. I mean, even when it was, but they never. It was really like, in the end, it wasn't really what they needed. What they needed in the end was highly motivated, highly mobile force with some good anti-tank weaponry. Right? It wasn't necessarily more money and more weapons. It's just in the end, and they were poorly led. Nguyen Van Thieu would never again. He fancied himself as a political strategist, but in the end, when the crunch came, he certainly couldn't do it. And I think the Americans. I think if Nixon had not been rolled in Watergate, there's no question he would. There's no question he would have done something. But of course, and that's another thing that Congress banned any further. Banned any further military action. Remember that in 64. So. It was like, and you see indications of that these days.
Sorry, they banned it in 74.
Yeah, 74.
In 74, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, where they said no more U.S. troops.
Yeah.
So even if Nixon had still been president in 75, he probably wouldn't have done anything. Maybe he could have blustered his way and done something, but he was really doomed after Watergate, frankly.
Well, tell us about your own experiences in 74, particularly April 75, with the fall of Saigon pending. Now, you had a good reason to evacuate. You weren't in love with communism. You'd married a gorgeous woman, Kim Jong, and you had a family, and you wanted to get out, and they got out, and then you got out. Good reason. The leading left-wing journalist at the time, John Pilger, who sort of spoke about the fall of Saigon as the liberation of Vietnam, he jumped on one of the American helicopters and went off on the Blue Ridge. So I thought he probably should have stayed and welcomed the liberation. I can see why you left. But what was the feeling like as people are running to, I'm not sure what final helicopter you're on, one of the last half a dozen, was it?
Oh, I left earlier in the afternoon.
And it all closed down
near
the
airport.
Yeah.
And that came under artillery fire. And then they switched to the embassy, which they had never planned to use.
The Americans switched to the embassy to pick people up from the roof.
Yeah,
from the U.S. embassy.
They had to cut down a tree and make room. But the original plan was for the evacuation to take place out near the airport, which is where I left.
But the airport had fallen around the time you were to go and fallen to the north.
Yeah, it was coming under increasing
attack.
Artillery fire.
Okay,
Going back a moment, I would have liked, after spending all that time in Vietnam, I would have actually liked to have been there to see the end. Right? It's like not watching the end of an all night movie. Right? I had to see the end of it, even though the
tanks crashing through the
I think I deserved to see that. I've always laughed that Pilger, for all of his his lefty bluster, he was on one of those choppers too, right? I mean, he should have stayed. And those who stayed, of course, they let them, like the AP was able to send out a Saigon has fallen, and then they pulled the wire, right? So then they had 6 weeks of doing nothing. But in the end, it was my Confucian duty, right, to get out. Some of her family are not at all. And, of course, it was the follow-up story is that Kim Il-sung's father ended up in a communist re-education camp.
For how long?
For 4.5 years. But even...
Hang on just one second. Was he a very vocal opponent of the regime, or was he just someone who wasn't a supporter of the regime? I mean, he was
a member of the popularly elected provincial council, which was an attempt to sort of grassroots democracy going. But he was in the government recognized labor union before that. But he wasn't a government official or in the military.
But he still got 4.5 years.
He's got 4.5 years, and it was thanks to Australian diplomatic intervention that he was released. Thanks to Andrew Peacock.
So what did Andrew Peacock? Who asked Andrew Peacock to intervene?
I did.
Okay, so you succeeded there.
Yeah, when I was with Newsweek in the 80s, as you said.
Well, as you know, the Fraser government was very good in trying to get diplomats and others out and friends of Australians out. The Whitlam government, of course, had a miserable record. It didn't want to get anyone out, apart from people who weren't under any threat. It didn't want to get anti-communists out. So at any rate, so you jump on a helicopter and you land where? On an American ship?
Yeah, we landed on a U.S. Navy ship that was closest to the shore.
Yeah, and then we went to
the Blue Ridge, where we hung around for a while because we had.
So John Pilger was on the Blue Ridge. Did you meet him?
No, but we hung around because our ship was carrying landing craft.
Yeah,
and we were picking up the very first of the boat people.
I see. They were fleeing already.
Hmm?
The boat people were fleeing already.
We were picking up the very... Yeah. I have pictures. The very first boat people were... We were close to shore. We were picking them up and sending them off to freighters. But there were... So we stayed on station. By the time we got the Blue Ridge, John Pilger and all the other journos had left.
Yeah.
And then from there, we were flown to the Philippines.
Okay. So we're getting to the end. Tell us a bit about yourself. I mean, you got over the heroin addiction. How hard was that?
Well, I got on a chopper and left.
You went cold turkey on an American chopper.
Well, I mean, it was... That's the simplest way to put it, right? I mean, I don't know how serious an addiction... It wasn't shooting up in a Saigon alley, right? It was just smoking this stuff, and I could go off. I took female menstrual tablets to do the cramps, right? So I was quite used to going on and off. But if I were to give advice to addicts, I would say the best thing is to get out of where you are.
Yeah.
So I had no reason ever in New York afterwards or in Australia. I never even had a desire or interest. Much less to smoke something that's so adulterated, right? After the quality stuff that I had.
Well, I'm not experienced in this, but I can understand.
I got away from it.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole. I think in the book you'll almost understand why and how it happened. But,
so do you reckon your journalism was better on the smack or off the smack? You know.
Oh, it was just a drudge, you know, just covering it. But I functioned. I fully functioned.
So. You come to Australia, you fall out with Associated Press. Do you want to explain that? or not bother about it? Oh, it was just another journalistic row, was it?
No, after... I think it was... I spent 2 years in New York, and then they sent me down here because I wanted to get overseas again. And it was like the last place to send a war correspondent is Australia, even now, right?
Yeah.
It was really hard. It was really hard coming up with coming up with very much news, and I wasn't really performing. I mean, my wife was totally torn up over her family, losing her family. The best thing about Australia was you had diplomatic relations with Vietnam. So the first thing when we got here, we were able to send money and letters and all that, and eventually get him out of a camp and migrate to Australia. So
how many of Kim's family got out here?
Eventually, we got the parents and two brothers out here, but it took 10 years.
And who remained?
No, they all got out.
They all got out either
here or to the U.S.
Okay, well that.
And then a sister came out later in 1990. So
I think we'll finish on this because. Apart from your many activities and your many talents, you end up working on the film The Quiet American, which, as you know, has an Australian connection. So tell us about the Australian connection. Why were you there, and was it good fun?
Well, Kim Jung had met Philip Noyes, the director, when they were doing a prototype of SBS, you remember?
Yes.
And they had all these big-name Australian directors, and Philip was given the Vietnamese, and we were put in touch, and... So she and Philip spent a lot of time together putting together some vignettes, and they became good friends. And then once he got his hands on the Quiet American, he says, "You two are like the Quiet American." He reminded me you have the aid worker and then journalist, and then she was the charming girl in the booth. So he always wanted to do a movie. So when he finally did it, he finally managed to get Michael Caine and Brendan Fraser. And so, and the filming was here at Fox Studios. So, and one scene that they needed, in fact, you couldn't write it out. You couldn't write it off like the Killing Fields had an opium smoking scene, but they had to have it. In fact, the movie starts with the bubbling, and that was me. And then, so while they were off shooting in Vietnam, they were able to shoot it on location in Vietnam. I was working with the crew here in Sydney at Moore Park to come up with something that looked and burned like opium, but wouldn't kill Michael Caine. But it was wonderful hanging out with Michael Caine and Brendan Fraser as well.
So you start off as a journalist in Vietnam in 1964, and you end up as the heroin advisor to the Quiet American.
Opium smoking.
No, we didn't. Opium smoking. Opium advisor smoking. To the Quiet American.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm actually called something else. But I when the producers came out from Hollywood, I said, that's what I want you to say on here, because the scenes were really... I mean, I was really proud of how well they worked out.
It was a great thing.
Because anyway, we didn't have the real product.
Yeah.
But there is...
what a shame.
The book portrays the opium things like in Cambodia and so on. We all thought we were Graham Greene, hanging out in opium dens.
Well, Graham, I'm sorry, Carl. Thanks a lot, and well done.
You're welcome.
Good luck with the book.
Good.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.